This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The first weeks of Donald Trump's presidency have been marked by a slew of controversial executive orders, prompting sweeping policy changes on immigration and health care. But beyond policy, what does a Trump presidency show Americans about their own identities? Duke Law Professor Jedediah Purdy examined the ways in which Trump gained support and what his message and delivery tells us about the state of American politics. Jed Purdy joins me now. Welcome back, Jed.
Hi, Frank. Good to be with you.
It's great to be here. So you've written about Trump's distinctive style and what it shows us about the way we're talking about politics. Tell me more.
Well, Trump does things differently from other Republicans and other politicians generally. You can point to a few things. The emotional tone of his candidacy and his public presence is much more aggressive, much more personally aggressive, and in a certain way, much more emotionally bipolar. There's a lot of flipping between anger and self-assertion on the one hand, and then a lot of invocations of love. He talks about love more than any national politician probably has ever done, but it feels like a very aggressive and even coercive form of love. One of the rationales of this executive order, the travel ban, was that we are only going to let people into the country who love us deeply and in the right way. So what does this lead to? Another distinguishing thing about Trump is that he doesn't talk about the Constitution. Whether you're left or right, whether you're Barack Obama or Ted Cruz, an image of the country's national community being based in constitutional text and principle has been a very standard refrain for American politicians. And they can make it sing left or sing right, depending how they want to tell the story. The only part of the Constitution Trump really talks about is the Second Amendment, and he uses that as a way to talk about being so scared of dangerous people that you need guns. He talks instead about the country in terms that are ethno-national and religious in a variety of ways. It's us versus the Mexicans, it's us versus the Muslims, it's us versus the criminals, it's us versus the terrorists. He said in the campaign more than once that Christians need to band together the way Muslims do, implying that Muslims do, quote unquote, implying that this is a Christian nation. So we're talking about a shift in the basis of national community from a kind of abstract arrangement of political principle, which everyone is part of in theory, even if we fight over the terms, to a more partial and exclusionary idea where the people is just part of the people, and it's just the people who are with him.
Wouldn't you say that was also true in the Reagan administration, this real division between us and them? I mean, it did point generally to beyond our borders, this enemy without, but and certainly George yes. Bush, you're either with us or you're against us. I mean, we've heard this kind of rhetoric before. How do you think Trump is different?
Well, this is important. I think too many liberals are so shocked by Trump that they want to say that we've never seen anything like this before. This is unprecedented in American life. And I think that exaggerates the civilization and decency of American political life up to this point. The distinction between friends and enemies, us and them, runs through politics. It has better forms and worse forms. When it works at the level of national identity, not just about defining the country in contrast to opponents or others abroad, but actually drawing the lines within the country and saying some people who are here, who are legally here, who may be citizens, who are part of the economy, are nonetheless not us in a basic way. I think that's a line that's dangerous. And that line is more pronounced now than it's been since the Red Scare, and I'd say more pronounced now than since the explicit white supremacist politics of the early 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. If you think about the way in which the communist scare worked for especially conservatives in the middle part of the 20th century, this was a way to really align workers now on a kind of new nationalist way of thinking, which prior to World War II wasn't true. Workers really were concerned about worker rights over and against capital's rights. Mm-hmm. And that meant that they may have solidarity elsewhere.
Yes.
And this finally aligned and said, if you're a union worker, you're anti-communist and therefore one of us. And by the way, we'll take care of you with a nice union contract.
Yes. I'm so glad you used the word solidarity. It's been on my mind a lot because Trump used it in his inaugural address. It was the first time the word had been used in a presidential inaugural. And it's traditionally a word of the left and a word of the labor movement, as you say. And this year, I would say all of the political energy in the primaries, and it turned out in the general election as well, was between people who wanted to reject the free trade, free market consensus that has pretty much held together the mainstream Democratic and Republican parties for 20 to 30 years, and wanted a stronger idea of what the country owes people by way of economic security and sort of sense of economic belonging. And there were two versions of that. One was Bernie Sanders' version, which drew on many of the same discontents that Trump appealed to, but was explicitly anti-racist and focused on workers' power and workers' self-organization. And Trump's version, which is about solidarity with the right people and for the right people. So Trump's version of solidarity comes back to this way of talking about the country, where it's for some of us, but not for all of us. It's also not at all for him about workers' power. It's about the strong man muscling the company to get some more jobs, preferably probably non-union jobs.
Well, that gets to this kind of totalitarian template, right? The way in which you gather power in the totalitarian model is to first convince a gullible population that everything is falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be evidence in their lives that a lot is falling apart.
That's
and in
right.
my life, things are really bad. I'm not well educated. I can't get a good job, and I will not send my children to a good school. And that promise was true for my father, not for me. So it feels like the world's falling apart. In fact, it's not. A, and then B, I'm the one who can fix it. And so you have to sort of turn over, because you have no agency. You mm-hmm. clearly you have no power. Mm-hmm. And your sense of powerlessness then finds a home in the leader.
This is exactly the model of leadership that Trump has offered throughout the campaign, and the model of legitimacy that he's offered. We're in a disaster. It's a catastrophe. Things are falling apart. You've got nothing. And I'm the only one who can fix it. It's a completely delusional idea of how political action works, but it's charismatic in a kind of bent way.
And the feeling was that kind of thing could never happen here. A totalitarian, authoritarian, charismatic leader could never take control of the apparatus in this country. And there's evidence now that we're seeing tendencies in that direction. If it was true, this may not be a totalitarian mm-hmm. president. We don't know yet. But could it be true? And if it were true of this country, in other words, what's wrong with the premise that it could never happen here?
Yes.
What would it take to have that kind of thing happen
yes.
here?
What's wrong with the premise? I think for 30 years, part of the reason Democrats as well as Republicans thought so little about economic inequality, thought so little about insecurity, thought so little about the things that gave people in their own lives the sense that, as you said, stuff was falling apart and things were bad, was that they believed they were living at the end of history and there were going to be no more ideological challenges to the order of things, no more crises like this one. And so what did they not do? They didn't correct the role of money in politics. They didn't correct the ideologically distorting effects of gerrymandering. They allowed inequality and insecurity to become the everyday experience of an enormous number of people with no sense that there was anything wrong with this or that there was any alternative. In fact, the thought that there was nothing that could be done about this, that this was the direction of history and there was no alternative, I think is part of why this terrible broadside has come as such a shock. It's not only a political shock, it's a kind of metaphysical shock to be thrown back into history where liberalism, democratic socialism, and a kind of incipiently fascist nationalism are fighting for control of the state and for the identity of the country.
There's been, certainly there was a sea change in 1980 in the way we understood the role of government and its role in social relations and economic relations. In other words, the part it would play in the economy, in our daily lives, and also in other political
yes.
ways. So if you can, just roughly describe that contract that we had about the way government
right.
regulation would actually protect us, that government was protecting our freedom, and that got turned on its head by Ronald Reagan, that freedom meant letting other corporations do what they want to you.
Yes. So the middle part of the 20th century was unique in American history in two respects. The one that we know more about is that economic growth was widely shared. Inequality in income and wealth was much less than it had been before and much less than it has come to be since. The thing that is a little less remembered is that right at the heart of this arrangement was a kind of peace agreement between a powerful labor movement that had taken decades and a lot of blood and suffering to build up, and a national state that had a fairly ambitious idea of what its role was in the economy, to keep people safe, to ensure the role of labor in managing the workplace and the economy, to ensure the dignity of everyday work and everyday life, not for everyone by any stretch. This was always a profound failure and source of crisis in this settlement. But for many people, this was what it meant to be an American citizen. And Franklin Roosevelt, in helping to build and explain the system, the period of the New Deal, talked about this as what it took to protect freedom under new circumstances in a complex economy and national and global markets. Ronald Reagan exactly reversed that and said, big government doesn't solve problems, it causes problems. I'm here to restore your freedom, and your freedom, as he put it, is the freedom to get rich. It's the freedom of one person to rise above his circumstances and win in a dog-eat-dog competition. And that's the version of freedom in economic life that we've been living with ever since. Bill Clinton's arrangement with the Democratic Party was in some ways to adopt much of that Reaganite premise and try to humanize it and make it more decent around the edges.
And he got lucky because there was a dot-com bubble that allowed more people to participate, but the fundamental structures hadn't changed. And so the abuse that the system was placing on working individuals who couldn't possibly achieve the lie of the Reagan administration's promise came home to roost in 2000.
That's right.
So you've got this thing, but now it seems to me it's at cross currents because you have a president who doesn't even embrace that notion of freedom. Let corporations be free to do what they want with their money, though labor, you'll notice, doesn't cross a border as freely. So if I'm a dollar and I can make more money in Mexico than in the United States because of poor environmental controls and lower wages and a lower standard of living there, my dollar should go there. If I'm a Mexican worker and I could make more money here, we're going to stop you. That's always been true. What about this? But the idea now that Donald Trump wants to force corporations to come back here, produce products at what we have to assume is going to be a higher cost, this runs across purposes with that theory.
It does. It does. In his rhetoric and in his public theater, the policy theater of bullying individual companies and trying to get them back, he's very much at odds with the free market ideology of the mainstream Republican Party. On the other hand, in that ideology, you could say, has been honored more in the breach than in the observance. Every company has always been delighted to take regulatory subsidies, spending subsidies, whether it's big ag or big pharma or whatever else. And the reality of Trump's politics looks like it's going to be fraudulent populism and continued large-scale capitulation to companies looking for handouts. So I think the question in some ways is going to end up being whether the shift in rhetoric to a Republican posture that talks populism but acts plutocracy is going to cause a genuine crisis, or whether that party is cynical enough, and whether its constituents are cynical enough just to pivot and keep on going.
So a lot of the rules are broken. There are a lot of obviously new models and new representations of power that we're seeing that are slightly different, in some cases radically different. What about resistance? Is that changing to meet the challenge?
Yes, there's a lot of fight in the country right now. The Women's March was extraordinary, powerful. In some ways, just as striking to me was the rush to the airports last weekend. In 30 cities across the country, tens, probably hundreds of thousands of people in all. What was remarkable about it was that it was spontaneous, for one. There had been, I think, background work by immigrants' rights organizations and refugee organizations, but most of us who were there actually didn't know anything about that background work. We went out of a sense that there were principles that had suddenly been thrown into stake, suddenly thrown into contention. There were people who were suddenly being made vulnerable, and it was our civic responsibility, for lack of a less grand way to put it, to go out and put our bodies in a space where we were announcing that we weren't going to go along with this. I think we may see, and I hope we're going to see, a lot more of this kind of
thing. But you will hear over and over again that a march is not a movement, that to sustain that, you're going to need some systemic way to keep that thing alive, and that would at least suggest a role for the Democratic Party, which has been not very efficient so far in mounting any kind of resistance. In fact, it's been complicit for decades, as you suggested, the Clinton era. Do you see this thing becoming a sustained movement?
A march is not a movement, but we may have underestimated how much marches can matter to building the energy that sustains movements. There's a sense of momentum and eagerness and urgency now. And I will say I've felt events both of these past weekends, a strange kind of joy tempering the alarm and despair, a sense that being out there together, saying what we're saying, matters in itself and is giving us more energy for all the other things that we're going to have to do. So I'm not sure I accept, and I suspect you don't accept, the thought that we have to choose between marches and movements. But I agree that movements need institutions to a certain extent. And the Democratic Party is the movement, is the institution that a progressive movement that wants to reestablish an anti-racist vision of economic security and solidarity that's not exclusionary should be aiming at.
Well, let me just stop you right on that point, because we had Ken Lewis here last week, who ran unsuccessfully in the Democratic primary for Senate in North Carolina in 2010. And he did it to test the premise that we're in a post-racial age and that something about Barack Obama's victory should change things for politics. And he was told by the Democratic Party in the state, look, black people don't win at that level. You can't make it. We're the progressive party. Mm-hmm. So put your effort and energy behind the white candidate who will speak for you. And he said that goes back to 1965. It's a strategy to push against the Southern, Southern strategy. And it's about time, given that the success that Barack Obama had twice in putting together a coalition of true progressives and minority interests, which dovetail beautifully. It's about time for the Democrats to do this. Of course, they famously didn't do that in the last election. Any sign that they're awake to, first of all, what would you make of Ken Lewis's premise to the extent that I've reflected honestly? And do you see any appetite in the Democratic Party to move in that direction?
I'll only say about his premise that I admire it. And even if he had turned out to be wrong, we wouldn't be any worse off. And I wish he'd had the chance to test it. I think the Democratic Party's cage needs to be rattled very hard right now. My sense is that they remain pretty complacent. They remain pretty much the same party that thought they could avoid the sorts of questions that Bernie Sanders had raised in the primary and run this campaign as one focused on what a distasteful and erratic individual Donald Trump is. And that turned out not to work. It was a very meritocratic kind of question that they were raising about him. He doesn't have the qualifications for the job. It wasn't a question of principle. His vision of the country is the wrong vision of the country. And I think that it's going to take a lot of work. Candidly, the kind of work that the Tea Party did in reshaping the Republican Party to make the Democrats more a party of principle on this front. There's been a lot of talk about copying the tactics of the Tea Party, like harassing your congresspeople, and I think that's excellent and effective, and I've been making more phone calls as a result than I used to do. But I think we should remember that the Tea Party was also a kind of ideological revolution within its own party, and the Democrats need that as well. A progressive version of it.
Jed Purdy is a law professor at Duke University, the author of many books, and you can find links to his latest pieces at our website, stateofthings.org. As always, Jed, a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, it is, Frank. Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about a new book that examines the murder of Emmett Till in the Mississippi Delta in the 1950s. Tim Tyson is here in a minute. Stay tuned.